You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from the new Amazon series Homecoming, directed by Sam Esmail, the creator of Mr. Robot. Based on the critically acclaimed podcast by Eli Horowitz and Mika Bloomberg, Homecoming stars Julia Roberts as Heidi Bergman, a caseworker at the Homecoming Transitional Support Center. But 4 years after starting a new life, Heidi is faced with questions about why she left the facility, and she realizes there's a deeper story beyond the one she's been telling herself. Don't miss Homecoming. Stream now, only on Amazon Prime Video. Loop is making engagement ring shopping easier with personal service, expert style advice, customization options, and beautiful inspiration to help you find a ring that fits your style and budget. All Loop rings are hand-set, individually screened by their team of experts, and meet the highest quality standards. Finding her ring is a big decision, so here's $100 off your ring to free up some extra dollars so you can take her somewhere nice and really do up that big proposal in style. Just go to loopjewelry.com/pages/kick and use code KICK. That's loopjewelry.com/pages/kick and offer code KICK. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. With over 100 million albums sold, The Who is considered one of the greatest rock bands of the 20th century. From classics like My Generation to Tommy, The Who defined that generation in the 60s and 70s and broke new ground in rock and roll, creating the first rock opera and inventing techniques like the windmill strum, the power chord, that's C-H-O-R-D, and the musical use of electrical feedback, influencing everyone from Pink Floyd to Jimi Hendrix. 7 of their albums rank on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list, and Tommy, My Generation, and Who's Next have been inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. The Who has also received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammy Foundation, been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and in 2008 became the first rock band ever to be honored by the Kennedy Center. It's a long way from the ragtag skiffle band that Roger Daltrey started with a few friends and a homemade guitar in 1959. Now the lead vocalist and founder of The Who writes about that wild musical journey in his new memoir titled Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite, My Story. And today, Roger Daltrey joins me on the podcast to talk about how the hardships his parents experienced during the Blitz in World War II paved the way for his generation to shake things up 2 decades later. He recalls what it was like to be the poster boys for the British mod revolution and why he never fully embraced that fad, and sums up what it was like to play Woodstock with one word: chaos. He talks about how he and Peter Townsend pushed each other's creative boundaries during the making of The Who's Tommy, how he managed to resist the drug-fueled excess of the 1960s and 70s, and how it led to quite a bit of tension between him and his bandmates, especially The Who's famously reckless drummer, Keith Moon. He also reveals how he processed Moon's tragic death in 1978, how it led to the band's breakup in the early 80s, and how a Silicon Valley con man got The Who to finally reunite years later. Coming up with rock and roll legend Roger Daltrey in just a moment. Roger Daltrey is the lead vocalist and founding member of the legendary rock band The Who. In a career that has spanned more than 50 years, he's produced 8 solo albums in addition to his work with The Who, was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1990, and received a Kennedy Center honor in 2008. Now he writes about his incredible rock and roll life in a new book that's being called one of the best rock memoirs in recent memory. It's titled, Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite, My Story. Roger Daltrey, welcome to the show, man.
How you doing, Ben?
I want to start by going way back to pre-Who. You were born during the Blitz, but not the one that most people think of. It was, the V1 rocket blitz at the end, huh?
Yeah, the people don't realize the Blitz was on the east end of London, which was all the dock area. And we lived in West London. But in 1944, Hitler had suddenly leased his V1 bombs on us, which were like a jet engine propelled missile.
Yeah,
you used to hear coming and then it would stop, and everybody used to just run because you never knew where it would fall. And that was kind of like, they called it a mini blitz. It was Operation Steinbock, and this was 1944, and it was the 29th of February when my mum started labour, and she was just determined I was not going to be a leap year baby. Well done, girl. It was during one of these air raids, so it must have been a really hairy time, because I can't imagine what my parents and my whole family and every other family in Britain must have gone through those years to kind of go down a shelter, come back out, and half the street would be missing, gone, just rubble. And the only similarity that an American can kind of draw for it on your shores, apart from a few kind of balloon bombs that fell on the West Coast, is 9/11, of course. And you can imagine the trauma that caused. Well, they were going down the shelters and coming up to that for almost 5 years.
Yeah.
So you can imagine what it did to them.
And you talk about the toll that it took on your parents, but you also say that what they went through in the 40s actually set the stage for your generation and what you guys would create in the 60s. Explain how that evolved.
Well, what they went through in the 40s was, by the war destroying everything, we had no option but to build.
Mm-hmm.
London was leveled, but what it did for us, it gave us a blank canvas of which to paint who we were, our generation coming up, which became the first adolescent, teenage generation with a little bit of spare cash to spend. So it gave us this blank canvas to paint on. And then from your country, along comes Elvis. And of course, every young sort of 11, 12, 13-year-old, pre-pubescent, into puberty, youngster in England, male, wanted to be Elvis. Every female wanted to give him a hug.
That's very PG.
Course, we couldn't be Elvis, but we immediately gone from these very straight, short back and sides haircuts, rushed out to the bathrooms, got hold of a bar of soap and slicked our hair back because we couldn't afford anything like any kind of hair treatment to get the same look. But the soap worked wonders. So there we were, and then along came this music, which was early American folk songs, Lead Belly songs, and Chain Gang songs, Appalachia songs, which were presented in our country as a music called skiffle.
Yeah,
by a guy called Lonnie Donegan.
That's a term we don't know here, but it was kind of roots music, right?
Yeah, and Lonnie Donegan was the one that I saw Elvis, and I thought, wow, what a dream existence that must be singing. I already knew I could sing because I'd been in a church choir. But when I saw Lonnie Donegan, he sang these songs and they kind of spoke to us in a different way. And the way he sang them, and by the way, he didn't look cool at all. He used to come on in a dinner jacket and a bow tie, But it was the way he sang and the songs he was singing. The fact that they were chain songs, these were songs of pain. These are songs of anger. There was all this other stuff going on in the words. Lonnie was the one that made me think, I can do this. I'd like to do this, because Lonnie used to throw his head back halfway through a song and just let rip. It was like, just like gospel music.
Uh-huh.
It became something much, much deeper in the way it touched me. So and the great thing about that music was that everybody could just get some kind of instrument. I made my first guitar. We couldn't afford to buy it.
Yeah.
So I made my first kind of acoustic guitar. by copying one that somebody lent my dad so I could get the size of it and look at how it was made. And I learnt the three chords of which you could play most of these skiffle songs. And, of course, once you get a guitar, learn the three chords and can start singing those songs, someone else picks up something and starts banging it. You get a washboard and some thimbles and you can get a rhythm section going, you know, and a tea chest, which was a kind of 2 foot, maybe 2 foot six, square plywood box with a string through the middle of the top, open end at the bottom, a broomstick and a piece of string. You could make that sound every bit as good as a double bass.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Fat Albert and his Junkyard Band.
Well, that's what it was, you know. It was kind of equivalent to a kind of jug band. Junkyard Band. And so every street very quickly had a skiffle band. And that's where the kind of the Who, or my bit of what became the Who, started. I had these, my old friend from school, Harry Wilson, he very soon came in as a drummer when we decided we'd move up from the washboard to a real drum kit. And it slowly, slowly progressed through the 60s.
Yeah, and I suppose there are plenty of people who might assume that The Who began with Pete Townsend, but you started the band when you were in, what, high school? And somewhere along the way, he auditioned and you brought him on. What did you think of Pete when you first met him?
Well, it was, I mean, first came John.
Or when he auditioned, because you knew him before that, right?
Yeah, I recognized them from school. They were in a year younger than me, but they were the kind of characters that you just could not hide in a crowd. They stood out. That's the only way I can kind of explain charisma. Yeah. They had it. Even then, they had it. And they stood out in a crowd. You couldn't hide them in a crowd of 5,000, especially Pete, whose nose at the time was very extremely prominent because we were just coming out of food rationing, which incidentally, 1945 was the worst year of the whole year. When the war was over, we had even less food for the first 18 months because we had to share what little we had with the Germans.
Yeah.
And, you know, a loaf of white bread was towards, you know, the middle of 1945, consisted of half a loaf of chalk just to make up the amount, you know. And that's what we have been fed on. But we survived it. Yeah. Anyway, so I'd noticed them at school, and the first one to join me was John Entwistle, who lived round the corner. And I bumped into him on the street coming home from the sheet metal work factory where I worked. And he was carrying a homemade bass guitar. And I thought, wow, someone of my own kind of mentality here, you know, because I had already made my first electric guitar by this time. And I talked to John and he said he was in a trad band and he played trumpet most of the time, but he was learning this bass guitar and he made it himself. It wasn't much better than my one, if as good. And I invited him. I said, you know, are you in a band? He said, yeah, I'm in this jazz band, and I, you know, it's really good, and we played quite a few youth clubs and things. I said, so I asked him if he was getting paid, and he said, no. He said, are you? And I said, yes. And I was lying through my teeth. So he invited me along. I invited him along to the next rehearsal of the band, and it was quite obvious that John was a musical talent. There was no doubt about it. He had a musicality about him immediately obvious to me. And he became our bass player. And at the time, I used to be on lead guitar. We had another guy called Reg on rhythm guitar, and he wasn't very good at all. And John on bass. We had my mate Harry on drums, and we had a singer called Colin. And we were kind of doing what kind of Cliff Richard songs, which is the British Elvis, which were all very soft and a little bit twee.
Yeah.
And our singer thought he kind of was Cliff Richard. We didn't. But anyway, after about 6 weeks, John said, you know, we're not going to get anywhere with Reg on this rhythm guitar. He said, I know someone who would fit perfectly in this band. And I said, oh, yeah, who's that? And he said, well, his name's Pete. And he's in the jazz band with, he was in the jazz band with me, and he played the banjo. He said, but he's a great guitar player. So I said, oh, bring him along then. So he brought him along the next week, and there was Pete Townsend with a rhythm guitar, and it was immediately obvious that this guy had something incredibly special, because he was playing chords the shape of which we'd never seen, and the sound of which and the rhythm of which we'd never heard. I mean, and maybe that came from his previous banjo playing, I don't know. Yeah, but he was immediately obvious that this guy was something special.
Yeah, it's funny to think that one of the greatest rock bands of all time pretty much began doing Dixieland jazz.
Well, we used to, but then because that's what they used to do. And then, of course, there was that period through the early 60s where people like Acca Bilk and Kenny Ball, there was a period where trad jazz actually charted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And became, and of course, in those days when you were playing the bars and the clubs and things that we used to play, if it was in the charts, you were expected to play it. So The Who actually did go back to be in a jazz band for two songs, and I played the trombone. So it's quite funny, really, when I think back of it. I mean, we would have done anything just to earn a crust.
Now, The Who became heavily identified with the British mod culture in the 60s, but you weren't a big fan of that. In fact, you say it really wasn't much of a movement at all.
Well, I wasn't a fan of it. I kind of loved it. I loved the fact that it was very different and it was very fashion-driven.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seemed to me that it had its pinnacle period, which lasted about 6 months, and then it became a mess, just like most fashions do. And that's when I kind of fell out of love with it. And I never could be a mod because I had curly hair.
That's right.
Which was the equivalent of, you know, having some sexual transmitted disease. You know, mods can't have curly hair. So it was a very difficult period for me. And we were this kind of long-haired blues band. And we met a guy who became our manager called Peter Meaden. But he recognised the importance of this new fashion movement that was evolving in London, and said they need a band as their figureheads, because the Stones are old hat now. They're done, you know, the Beatles are done. You know, you can't be a lookalike Stones. You've got to be something else, and this is who it is. So the lookalike Stones walked into a barbershop and walked out as the band for the mods. But equally inside, I was still a teddy boy.
Now, along that same time period, there was an incident where Pete broke a guitar, and suddenly that kind of recklessness became synonymous with you guys, which is something that you sort of resisted. The reckless image and the 60s drug culture wasn't really for you.
You know, once the drugs kicked into the rock business in a big way, in the early 60s it was amphetamine, which was mostly taken by the groups because we were doing two shows a night. You know, we'd work between 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. Then we'd drive maybe 50, 60, 70 miles to another gig, and then we'd work from 2 in the morning till perhaps 5 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
To stay awake that long, that's with the day job as well, by the way.
Yeah.
This is a Friday night.
Oh, that's right.
That can become quite a long day.
Yeah, for sure. Because you were working in factories for a lot of that time. Yeah, that was your day job. And then
the others were still at college. John had just started in an office, which was a whole different ballgame than working in a factory. But I couldn't do those drugs. I only wanted to be a good singer.
Mm-hmm.
And the amphetamine used to just dry me up. And my voice used to crack, and it was uncomfortable. I'd end up chewing my lip, and I just used to make me feel awful. So I didn't do them. The rest of the guys did, but it was controllable then. But then towards the 1965, on our first tour of Europe, it got very out of control in The Who. They were away from home, party time, you know, this is big time party time.
Yeah.
And I can't remember how many shows we did. It doesn't really matter. But by the last show, they were popping so many pills. The music was not only unlistenable, it was too fast. I couldn't even get the words of the songs into them. They were being played so fast, so loud and so messy. And I decided that, this band's either going to go forward or it's going to end. So I flushed all their drugs down the toilet, which was a rather nasty fight.
Yeah, and I guess for a few days you guys broke up until they realized
it was
that
a few weeks.
They were getting booed without you.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. I think I seem to remember it was about 3 or 4 weeks, and they did a few shows without me. But I was fine. I thought, well, I started this band, and I found that, you know, these people came to us with the energy of the universe. Somehow or the other, the ingredients I needed turned up.
Mm-hmm.
Can't explain it, but that was it. That's what happened. And I wasn't worried at all. I thought, well, I'll just start another band. Because by now, yeah, I knew I could sing. We'd had hit records and had a following. And it was only after a month that the management came back to me and they said, look, the management went to them and said, you've got to take him back because he's not working without Roger. The management came to me and said, look, they want you back, but they'll only have you back if you promise not to fight anymore. So I used to rule the band with an iron fist.
Yeah.
You know, I used to love a scrap. And,
but you didn't and, like so anything I said,
yeah,
that
well,
interfered
that's
with
great.
Music.
I said, yeah. But, There's only a slight problem. I said, you know, I will go back, but I'll do it, and I will not fight anymore. That's a deal. That's fine. That's easy to control. But I want them to give me their word that they won't take any drugs before they go on stage. I don't care what they do after. I mean, yeah, that's their business. Yeah. And that's fine. I'm not going to try to be make a moral judgment on this. I just wanted the band to be as good as it could possibly be. And you ain't going to do that when you're out of your box on Purple Hearts, you know.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Roger Daltrey when we come back in just a minute. In the next 60 seconds, you're going to learn how the Flatiron School can change your life. The Flatiron School will teach you everything you need to get a job in code, data science, or design, but they'll also prepare you for the jobs that don't even exist yet. Because this is a school designed to educate you in the art of change. So if you're feeling stuck, bored, or unfulfilled, Flatiron will teach you how to change things. You'll learn by making things, breaking things, and discovering how the future is being built. The results speak for themselves. Go to flatironschool.com/podcasts to read about graduates' new careers and salary ranges and explore upcoming courses as well as exciting new careers. You can start building your own new career in coding, data science, or digital design at one of Flatiron School's WeWork campuses or take courses online. Go to flatironschool.com/podcasts, read the reviews, and sign up for a free intro course. Enrollment is now open. It's time to future-proof your career and change things, starting with you. flatironschool.com/podcasts. Almost every day, we hear something on the news about a cyber attack. Sometimes it's just a bunch of pranksters, but more often, it's a foreign country with vast cyber resources trying to hack our power grid, our banking system, or our military's information networks. The National Security Agency plays a big part in protecting our country from cyber attacks, and you can help. The NSA is hiring technical professionals to serve on the front lines of information security. If you work in computer science, networking, programming, or electrical engineering, you can help keep your country safe. Design new hardware systems and networks, write faster, smarter programs, protect America's critical infrastructure, or help uncover what our adversaries are planning to do next. Learn more about careers at the National Security Agency today. Visit intelligencecareers.gov/NSA. That's intelligencecareers.gov/NSA. And now, back to the podcast.
There's this famous legend about Keith Moon, who was kind of the one who was always getting into trouble in the band.
He was legendary, there's no doubt about that.
He drove a Cadillac into a hotel in Michigan. Didn't personally witness that. Are you skeptical that that ever really happened?
Well, you have to read the book about that, because you're going to give all the whole book away.
But you think might have gotten ripped off by the tour manager.
Well,
right?
We was not the tour manager, our management.
Oh, your manager at the time, Kit Lambert. You had sort of a love-hate relationship with him, because you say creatively he was brilliant, but as a manager, he was pretty much a crook. I mean, when did you first realize he was ripping you off?
I never hated you for being... you've got the wrong word. It was not a love-hate. I loved him. Kit was the most lovable bloke. He was everything about him was very lovable. He was gentle, imaginative, incredibly creative, articulate, well-educated man.
Mm-hmm.
Uncomfortably gay. And you've got to remember, in this period of the 60s, when we first met him, that was illegal. You could go to jail.
Yeah, that was still illegal in the UK.
You could go to jail for being gay. I mean, how ridiculous was that? So, no, it was never love-hate. It was always love. But he had this side of him, which I only became aware of in 1970, I think it was 73, where it was quite obvious that they were screwing us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unnecessary. It was stupid. I never ever wanted to get completely rid of them, because of their creative genius. Both Kit and Chris Stamp, brother of Terence Stamp, the actor, were our managers, and they were incredibly creative. And that I never wanted to lose from the band. But we found them screwing us, and later on, it all turned very nasty. But you have to read the book of the reasons why. It was very sad for me. The drugs took them. I wish I had known now I knew then what I know now. Maybe things could have gone different, and we could have intervened in a way that could have helped them. But they were, by the time the end came for Kit, he was very, very heavily into mainline drugs.
Yeah, I think that you said in the book that you guys would go on this long tour and work your asses off, and then you would come back to your accountant and find out you guys were in debt from the tour.
It was hysterical. we had a meeting, and I can't ever forget it. It was in 1971, and by this time we'd had hit records for 6 years. And we had this meeting at our accountant's office, and he said, you've done really well this year. You've done all this work, done fantastic. And, last year you were over, it was about £550,000 in debt. And this year you'll be glad to know it's only gone up to £650,000. At which point, Keith, he completely stripped naked and put his balls on the table and his legs in the air. He said, "You want these as well?"
I want to ask you a little bit about what might be considered your most creative period. There was this transitional period between My Generation and The Who's Tommy, where the music was transforming sort of into this representation of Pete's inner monologue, and you busted through the bravado of the Mick Jagger style to explore deeper, less comfortable themes. As the front man of the band and the one who had to give voice to those lyrics, what was that transition like for you?
That was a very tricky time for me, because I I recognised Pete's genius as a writer very, very early on. And I was very comfortable with it right up to my generation. They're quite, you know, that was music to fight to.
Yeah.
real rock music. And then all of a sudden, and this was straight after the breakup and me being reintroduced to the band, I get presented with songs like Happy Jack.
Right.
I'm a Boy, Pictures of Lily. And I'm going, I had a kind of blues voice. I'm thinking, how do I get myself into this? So I thought, well, the only way I'm going to do this is to try and get some psychological understanding of Pete's interior. And that's where I tried to mold my voice into. And when I listen back to it now, I kind of succeeded because it almost sounds like I'm singing from the inside of myself. It's very weird.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a quality to it that is haunting.
Yeah. And you two kind of fed off of each other in that period.
Yeah, it's very weird. It's very, very, you know, because in the end, every singer-songwriter relationship to work really well has to have, it's all about empathy to each other.
Yeah.
And it shows that it was working even then, even though I was struggling every day with it. But the struggle, now I listen back, was well worth it.
Yeah, yeah, it worked big time. Now, I have to ask about Woodstock. It's been romanticized as the seminal moment of the 60s, but you don't have that many good memories necessarily of the experience. You say that it was complete chaos. What went wrong?
Well, nothing went wrong, but it was chaos. Mm-hmm. That was the first time for me, I realized that there is such a thing as fake news. Because on every news channel, I mean, I was in Connecticut staying with my mother and father-in-law at their house with Heather, my future wife. And we put on the TV, and of course, every headline news was about what a disaster Woodstock, how it had been rained out, and the governor declared it a disaster area. All the roads were blocked. Artists were being flown in and out by helicopter. It was, you know, it sounded like a war zone on the news. This was on the Friday night, the first day of the festival. Anyway, we were due to play on Saturday night, and I'm still in Connecticut preparing, thinking, well, how are we going to get there? Now they've blocked all the roads because we were going to just drive there. So anyway, Heather's dad just said, don't worry, he said, I'll drive, and we'll jump in the Volkswagen. So we went to Woodstock in a Volkswagen Beetle. And Herbie went to Woodstock, and you know, when it came to a roadblock or anything like that, we just drove up the grass verges and around them, and people just waved us through.
Yeah.
But it was chaos, but it was a kind of wonderful chaos. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go to those events, all you want to do is a great show.
Right.
And when you turn up to do the show, and we turned up at 7 o'clock at night, and you don't get on stage till 5 o'clock in the morning. and everything, you haven't had anything to eat, because there was nothing to eat, and whatever there was to drink was all laced with something or the other. You know, it becomes very difficult to kind of do the show you're capable of.
Yeah, it's a lot of distraction.
And I never thought we ever did a great show at Woodstock, but we did a show.
Yeah, and I think you said the promoters tried to screw you, didn't they?
Well, the promoters didn't want to pay anyone. they didn't want to, but we had to get paid because it cost us a lot of money to get there.
Yeah.
And it was going to cost us a lot of money, or let's put it this way, we'd have to learn to do a lot of swimming to get back.
Fast forward to the early 80s, Keith Moon passed away rather tragically, and you say that you and Pete had been expecting that day to come for years. When it finally happened, how did the two of you process that?
It was hard, to say the least. But you know, and it stayed with us. The music saved us. We thought, what do we have left? Because what it was, what we created, and what we realized very quickly was that whatever Keith created in his life existed mostly in the music we played with him on the drums. So it became quite, after we kind of got, you don't get over the grief of that for years.
I'm sure.
And I mean years. Because he was such a character. But we had the music, and that's what drove us on. And it was the same thing when John died. The music was all important. What we were given the gift of to create together comes first in the end.
Pete had said, The Who was four people who never should have been in a band together. And yet you guys, the four originals, lasted for a really long time for a rock band. Is that what you would attribute that success
to? Well, Pete says we should never have been in a band together, but that's because maybe to make the kind of music we were making, which has its own special kind of algorithm. There's something about Who music that is so unique.
Oh yeah,
and for instance, when Kenny joined the band after Keith died, Kenny is a fabulous drummer, but it just did not work with the Who.
Yeah,
and I say that not as an insult to Kenny. It's just that his algorithm was different. I mean, it was just. It would have been similar if you'd put Keith Moon in the Faces. It would have been, you can't imagine Keith Moon in the Faces. I mean, that would have no longer been a fun sing along a Faces band, would it? It would have been, whoa, what's going on here? So it was a similar thing with putting Kenny in the Who. So you suddenly realise then that Pete might have said, you know, you would never have put us four people together. But maybe that's where greatness comes from, is when you take enormous chances with characters. And you're four completely different characters, all alpha males, all kind of, all very quirky in different ways. But it worked. And we created something totally original. You know, if you put, you know, four people who you would expect to be in a band together, you get what you expected, and it will be dull.
Yeah, nothing surprising, nothing.
There was nothing dull about
the ground like that. After Keith died, you guys took a break for a very long time, and then I guess it was somewhere around the late 90s that you finally reunited. And in one of the crazier stories in the book, you say it was all because of a total con man. Who was this guy?
Oh, God. We got an offer come through for some ridiculous amount of money. I mean, it was $2 or $3 million to do one show in Las Vegas. If the Who appear, with one caveat, the show was to be staged to promote a company. What was it called? Help me out here.
I think it was a tech company.
Yeah, it was
right?
a tech company. It was in the dot-com bubble.
Shell company. It was a fraud, right?
And so this got the. This guy had this company that apparently was going to be doing early streaming on the internet. This was way back in 1999.
Okay. Sounds promising.
Yeah, and of course it did. It was $3 million or $2 million or some extraordinary amount of money. But with the caveat that one of us had to go down to this big tech conference on the south of France and talk about this company, and Pixelon, that's what it was called, and talk about the company and what it, you know, aimed to do. So, of course, Pete didn't want to do that bit. He wanted to do the gig for the money, but he didn't want to do the schlepping down the south of France and do the spiel. So I went down there and suddenly realised, I didn't have a computer. I knew nothing about tech industry at all. But I looked at the notes. I thought, well, she's all right. And when I went down there, it was, like I say, it was the early days of the dot-com bubble. And I was talking to all these people, talking all this stuff that I didn't understand. But it all sounded like cobblers to me. You know, I thought, well, if they can talk cobblers, I can talk cobblers. So I went up and did the speech to sell this Pixel on. This company's going to do this, and when the bandwidths do this, and when the bandwidths get bigger, pretending to know about bandwidths. The only bandwidth I knew was the width of the Who.
Yeah, the band you were with.
Yeah, exactly. So I did that bit, and I got, he paid all the bills, everything was up front. We went to Vegas, we did the gig, got paid. Everything fabulous. On the same thing, the same event, I think Aerosmith was on it. Loads of other big bands.
Yeah,
huge bands. Then it turned out, about 3 weeks later, the guy had been arrested. Everybody had been paid, by the way, by this time. That the whole thing was a confidence trick. You know, the Las Vegas job. Yeah, it was a guy who just wanted to have a huge party on the dot-com bubble. And that's what he did. He didn't make any money out of it. He just wanted to have a party for all his mates. Everybody
but
got
you
in
got
for
paid.
Free. Yeah, we got paid.
Okay, so who cares? Hey, whatever.
Yeah, and I learned to talk bullshit.
and the band got together because of that. Real quickly, before we go, you're not 20 years old anymore. What kind of a toll does it take when you're touring these days?
It's all right. It's okay. I mean, I can't do what I used to do. I've got no, I don't do as much physicality because my body's been wrecked so many times. So many car crashes, bang scrapes, and you name breaks. Equally, I can still swing the mic when I want to. I don't need to do it now. I'm more into making our music better than it's ever been. The music, because that's going to be our legacy, is Townsend's music, and I want to just get people to hear it. As good now as it ever was, if not better in different forms. Yeah. So that's my mission now. And at the moment, we're still doing that. If I ever come off stage and think I'm not delivering it in the way it should be delivered, because there is an energy in the Who that has to be there.
Yeah.
And if that flame ever leaves me, I will stop. I won't cheat my public. It's too important to me. Because then you're just dialing it in. And I've seen a lot of bands do that, and I loathe it. It's an insult to the audience.
Yeah.
And I remember just as a kid of 14 years old, saving up from my Saturday job to go and see Cliff Richard and the Shadows at the Jizzic Empire in those days. And that ticket cost me a lot of money. And they were brilliant that night, and I realised then that when you look out at an audience from the stage in this privileged position that we occupy, every one of those people, what they've gone through to put their bum on that seat, you owe it to them to be there. And if you don't, you deserve a kick in the ass. And there's a lot of bands I'd like to kick in the ass. Mention it, no names.
Well, I can't say that you don't give your fans their money's worth. Once again, his memoir is called Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite, My Story. Roger, it's been fun. Thanks for sitting down.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Roger Daltrey for coming on the podcast. Order his book, Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite, My Story, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow The Who on Twitter at The Who. The Flatiron School will teach you everything you need to work in code, data science, and design. You'll learn by making things, breaking things, and discovering how the future is being built. The results speak for themselves. Go to flatironschool.com/podcasts to read about graduates' new careers and salary ranges and sign up for a free intro course. Enrollment is now open. flatironschool.com/podcasts. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.